You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Want to know another Snapple fact? The first hot air balloon passengers were a sheep, a duck, and a rooster. Ridiculous. Check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavored Snapple near you.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey there, listeners. We're trying to spread the word about Kick-Ass News, and if you enjoy listening to the show, I'd like to enlist your help. First, if you haven't already, subscribe to Kick-Ass News on Apple Podcasts, and be sure to rate and review us while you're there. A 5-star rating and a few lines expressing your appreciation for the show is one of the easiest ways to show your support for Kick-Ass News and help new listeners find us. I also want to encourage you to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod. And if you're feeling really ambitious, share Kick-Ass News with your friends on your social media and encourage them to subscribe. You guys are what make this podcast what it is, and a little help from each of you will help keep Kick-Ass News growing. Thanks in advance, folks, and now on with the show. Hi. I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Legendary comedy writer and director Larry Charles has developed a reputation for being creatively fearless on groundbreaking TV shows like Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm, as well as some of the most subversive and hilarious films of the past 2 decades, including Borat, Bruno, The Dictator, and Religulous. And while the term dangerous gets thrown around a lot among folks in his business, Larry recently found out just how perilous it can be in Larry Charles' Dangerous World of Comedy. On this new Netflix docuseries, Larry travels the world in search of humor in the most unusual, unexpected, and deadliest places, from Nigeria and Somalia to Saudi Arabia and Iraq. And on today's podcast, Larry Charles says Americans are wrong to assume that war zones are humorless. In countries that experience oppression, conflict, and even genocide, comedy becomes more than just entertainment, but a means of coping, healing, and bringing about social change. He talks about meeting former child soldiers who perform stand-up in a cemetery in Liberia, the John Stewart of Iraq who has a price on his head, and the imprisoned terrorist who wanted to show Larry the lighter side of ISIS. He even reveals there's some pretty dangerous comedy right here in the U.S., including a white nationalist group that tries to use humor to spread hate. Larry also tells stories about working on the early seasons of Seinfeld, why Kramer was his favorite character to write for, and what he says Seinfeld has in common with Superman. He describes how Larry David used to fight with audiences in comedy clubs, why David threw a fit when NBC wanted to move Seinfeld to the most coveted time slot in television, and what it's like to direct Larry David on Curb Your Enthusiasm. We discuss how his films Borat and Bruno exposed racist and authoritarian leanings in the U.S. and abroad long before the 2016 election, why Larry Charles had to play a character while directing those movies, and the crazy amount of commitment it required from that mad genius, Sacha Baron Cohen. Plus, what it was like to grow up in Brooklyn's Trump Village, yes, that Trump, how Larry went from selling drugs to selling jokes outside the Comedy Store in Hollywood, and the one country that scared the living hell out of him while making Larry Charles' Dangerous World of Comedy. Coming up with the hilarious Larry Charles himself in just a moment. Larry Charles is an Emmy-winning writer, director, and producer who wrote for the first 5 seasons of Seinfeld, coming up with some of the show's most memorable episodes, before working with Larry David again as director and executive producer on Curb Your Enthusiasm. His other TV credits include The Tick, Dilbert, Entourage, and most recently, the FX series The Comedians. He directed the movies Borat, Bruno, and the documentary film Religulous, among others. And now he's stepping in front of the camera for a new comedic docuseries called Larry Charles' Dangerous World of Comedy, which is available on Netflix beginning February 15th. Larry Charles, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
I'm so excited about this new show of yours, Larry Charles' Dangerous World of Comedy, because I love the idea that you're exploring comedy in places where it truly is dangerous. And I'm not talking like dangerous in America, where you say something un-PC and gets on YouTube and a bunch of social justice warriors go and hate tweet you. Literally, comedians who are criticizing the institutions and leaders and even terrorist organizations in places where they could lob your head off for something
yes,
like that.
Yes, and paying the price for it quite often. Yes. That was part of my journey here. I was very interested, having traveled so much, to do American films and commercials in other countries where there were oppressive regimes, and seeing in every country I was in, no matter what, there was always a comedy scene there. There were always comedians. No matter how dictatorial the government was, totalitarian the government was, there were always comedians. And I thought, well, I get to go home. I get the rewards. I get the accolades. But these people are forced to stay under those conditions. What's it like for a comedian under those conditions? How do they survive? And that question started to plague me. And as Trump came into office and we became more isolated and realized we don't know anything about the rest of the world, but the rest of the world knows everything about us, I thought this is something I'm uniquely qualified to bridge this particular gap.
Yeah, and I think most Americans just assume that places like Somalia and Syria and Iraq, there are places where there's war and genocide and so much misery that there's no room for comedy.
Yes, well, that's almost true in a lot of cases. Mm-hmm. There are not a lot of venues. It's not an industry the way it is in this country, but it's a need.
Yeah.
And that's what I was most struck by, possibly, was that it transcended economics. It was really about a need to heal, to express the frustration, to talk about and process the trauma that these societies are all undergoing together. And so I saw comedy working on a much more transcendent level than you really see in this country, where the stakes are just not the same.
Yeah. And you yourself have a reputation for being dangerous and subversive creatively on shows like Seinfeld, Curb, Religulous, Borat, Bruno. But these people take it to the whole next level. Did you feel almost a little sheepish, alongside some of them?
It's very humbling. It's very humbling to talk to comedians whose families have been murdered.
Wow.
Talk to comedians who've been imprisoned and tortured, and meet comedians who were friends with comedians who've been assassinated. So, you don't really have that kind. Your comedy friends in Los Angeles don't usually have that kind of background.
Yeah. Setting aside the political context, I wonder who was the straight up funniest comic that you encountered along the way?
Wow. Well, I was in America too, because I wanted to interview Native American comedians. I thought that living under that kind of those kind of conditions and still doing comedy was a very similar kind of pursuit to the way it was internationally. So I interviewed Native American comedians. I interviewed a woman who is a former drug dealer, ex-convict, who's now a comedian. I'd have to say she may be the funniest person I met. Her name is Ms. Pat. She's out of Atlanta. We interviewed her for the show. We have a lot of her stand-up in the show. She's somebody that will make you laugh.
Yeah.
Make you laugh out loud. There's a lot of people, and depending on the kind of humor you like, or even if you don't get it, I have humor in different languages in this show, and some of it's just going to make you laugh because, again, it transcends language.
Yeah, and I heard that at some point you started talking to alt-right comedians here in the U.S. who make racist and un-PC jokes and that kind of stuff. What kind of things did they joke about? Is it even stuff that you're comfortable repeating?
Well, I think you have to see the show to hear what they said.
Okay.
I don't think I can repeat a lot of what they said. But I think the overall theme of that section is, starting with Trump, I see Trump as a kind of a failed comedian. He wants to be funny. He's desperate to be funny. He loves being funny, but he's not funny. So a lot of the stuff that he says that people are horrified by and offended by are his idea of a joke. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he realizes how tone deaf some of those jokes are. And I think that there's a whole generation of people who are enjoying the humor of making other people angry.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always been that genre of humor, of kind of prank humor, but it's usually been a left-wing practice, you know, and I think it shifted as the left wing became more politically correct and more sensitive and more easily offended. The right wing began to sort of cling to those older values and started to enjoy the idea of making the left wing squirm about the things that they felt precious about. And I think that there's a whole genre of humor that's kind of emerged out of that, and it's kind of anti-humor, and it's been around, but it's in a very different form now. And I think that's what these alt-right comedians are kind of representing.
Well, let me ask you this, because there's been this weird overlap lately between the people on the alt-right and quite a few comedians on the subject of political correctness.
Yes.
As someone who is pretty fearless and submissive, subversive, I mean, but maybe submissive in private. I don't know. Subversive, you know, as a comedian and, you know, creatively, what do you make of this weird alliance between comedians and the alt-right? Or maybe it's not an alliance, but like an overlap.
I think there is a dominance in comedy, as there is in the culture, of an older white male demographic. And I think they, and this includes me, we have a shared reference point in our upbringing, in our the things that interested us, music, movies, TV, comedians, and the things that we thought were outrageous. And at the time when we were first exploring that outrageousness, any of these ideas, blackface, all these things were very, very common in the culture at the time. And I think a lot of people who really enjoyed that period see that as a golden age and as a fun time, and no one was getting hurt, but they didn't realize the implications of being in this kind of hierarchical, white hierarchical power position. And that, to some degree, is what made those things funny. And the world is expanding, and I think you have this conflict now between a whole group of people who don't find those reference points funny and don't share them and are creating their own reference points. And I think, like, the country has fragmented in the face of Trump, and there's many, many different factions now, even within the alt-right or with the progressive left. It's the same thing in comedy. There are now many voices in comedy, many factions in comedy, and it's a good thing. It's a healthy thing, and eventually perhaps it'll synthesize into what that next American voice of comedy is.
And I like your assessment of Donald Trump when you said that he thinks he's a comedian, but he's not. He's just not very funny. And I've said that a number of times to people. I said, all this stuff that we're getting so outraged about, I don't think that he's serious about it. I think he thinks he's being funny in the moment when he's talking to someone, and then it gets reported in print, and then it sounds like a horrible, horrible idea.
And again, I think he's the master purveyor of this idea of getting liberals pissed off. I think one of the things he enjoys about those Pocahontas jokes, he likes seeing people get upset. He likes seeing people squirm. He enjoys that. It's kind of sadistic in a way, but it's also, humor has a sadistic quality to it as well.
Sure. You know? Yeah, and I hear that from people on the right all the time these days. You know, even if they can't point to a single policy that actually is in line with their conservative values, they'll say, but he pisses off the media. As if, you know, if we go to war with Russia or Iran and all this stuff, you know, it doesn't matter. Hell, if he suddenly switches and decides he's pro-choice, they're okay with that.
Exactly.
As long as he pisses off the media.
It's not about the ideology, really. You're right. Yeah. Absolutely right about that. I agree.
Yeah, and it's weird because I was thinking back to Borat. And that movie, looking back, it almost seemed to presage much of what we're seeing today with the alt-right and the racist elements in the U.S. coming to full fruition in terms of, you know, the way that Kazakhstan is portrayed in the movie, the fictional version. It now seems to be realized where all the stands and all of, you know, these Eastern European countries or former Baltic states are starting to turn away immigrants, and a new flourishing of xenophobia and racism.
Yeah, I think that Borat really was about America's cultural imperialism and kind of being ignorant about the rest of the world also. So he was able to come here and say that he was from Kazakhstan. People don't know anything about Kazakhstan, and he was able to sort of exploit that for the satire, you know. The truth is, in some ways, Bruno, our follow-up movie, was a sort of a more acute examination of some of the darkness of the American society at that time. It was a harbinger of this homophobia, of the sexism, of the superficiality of the dialogue in the culture. And so we saw a much darker version of America when we shot Bruno than we did with Borat. Borat was an innocent, and people were very forgiving and patient, but Bruno was gay. Mm-hmm. And so that was enough right on the surface for people to be hostile to him, to get physical with him, to feel comfortable cursing him out, insulting him, confronting him. And we saw a very different, much darker version of America there, a much more hate-filled America. It was also just at the time that Obama had been inaugurated, and there was a lot of racial hate that was kind of fermenting on the surface also. So that movie really reflects that time in the same way that Borat reflected that kind of Bush era in some ways.
And I'm trying to remember, where was that on the timeline in terms of when Russia started passing all these anti-gay laws? Was that before or after?
That stuff was happening parallel to, it's interesting now knowing how much Russia has interfered in a lot of our issues, whether they were also contributing to the anti-Prop 8 thing, the gay marriage. I wonder. You know, you don't know where that started. Yeah. Right? It would make sense that they would be involved in that.
Yeah. Now, when you were traveling around the world for Larry Charles' Dangerous World of Comedy, did you ever get up on stage yourself in some of these countries? Well, I used to be a comedian, right?
I did stand up. I wasn't very good at it. And I stopped pretty early on to start selling jokes, and that I did pretty well. And really kind of led me to this place. But so, no, I didn't get up on stage and perform, but I was, The Daily Show is the format is used all around the world.
Yeah.
So there's an Iraqi Daily Show, there's a Nigerian Daily Show, there's a Saudi Daily Show.
Yeah.
They're all over the place, and they're called different things, but it's the Daily Show.
Yeah, I had Bassem Youssef on a while back who did the Daily Show of Egypt, and then he had to flee the country.
Right, exactly. So Ahmed Al-Bashir hosts the Iraqi version of the Daily Show. He has to do it in a different country because he's also running for his life as well. But I appeared on that Daily Show, and I appeared on the Nigerian Daily Show, which was a kick. It was fun.
What kind of things do they talk about on the Nigerian or the Iraqi Daily Show?
Well, as you can imagine, they have governmental problems like we do. Nigeria is filled with corruption, oil corruption. The politicians are all bought off.
Yeah.
There is also in Nigeria, they have a rampant rape culture. And the male comedians are, in the way we're talking about political correctness here, the male comedians there are using rape humor on stage to great effect. I mean, people are enjoying it, and it's creating a tremendous conflict in the society. So there's a lot of talk about men and women and their role in Nigerian society. In Iraq, you have a series of governments that are corrupt, that are falling. There's confusion. And Al-Bashir is making fun both of the government and their inability to govern and ISIS at the same time. So he's making enemies on both sides.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Do you think that those rape jokes would fly here in the U.S.?
I think this is what's interesting. 10 years ago, yes, they would have. I mean, actually, they are 10-year-old American rape jokes to a large degree.
Oh, really?
Yes, that are being recycled in Nigeria because who knows those jokes, you know?
Sure.
But no, they would never fly here now. It would be stopped immediately and shouted down and just put to a halt. But 10 years ago, or 20 years ago when blackface was acceptable in movies like Soul Man, it's not that long ago. And rape was considered a source of humor. Absolutely. Wow.
At some point in the notes here, I was reading that you went to Liberia and you talked to drug-addicted former child soldiers who performed comedy in some kind of an abandoned cemetery.
Correct.
Boy, talk about an alt comedy room.
Exactly. But that goes back to my point about the economics.
Mm-hmm.
These are people that don't have any hope of ever making a living from this. This is a need they have. You reach a kind of an end point in life sometimes. And for these ex-child soldiers and a lot of the people that I met, they have a couple of choices in life. They're at that cliff. They're at that precipice. And they have a couple of choices. Do they jump off and end it? A lot of people do. Do they lash out at others? A lot of people do. But there's a third alternative that I discovered in this show and that I hope to find, and I did, which is you can step back from the cliff and you can survey the situation and realize how absurd it is. And there's a level of silliness to even the most dire, despairing situation. And that's where the humor resides. And these people made that choice to step back and use humor as a survival tool rather than murder or suicide.
Mm-hmm. Is that something that you relate to, this idea of comedy as a coping mechanism versus a career? Because I know that you grew up in what you've described as a pretty rough neighborhood of Brooklyn.
Yeah. Yes. Comedy was I learned inadvertently, without even realizing it, that comedy was a coping mechanism. I learned how to talk my way out of a lot of violent situations. I had to learn how to be sort of one step ahead. Mm-hmm. A lot of times I had to address an audience, but it was an audience of gang kids that just wanted to kick my ass. So I got used to sort of this dynamic of having to constantly be shifting and being flexible and calling audibles at the line of scrimmage in life. And of course, for Borat, it wound up being a great asset.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Yeah, so that worked out. It wound up working out very well, yeah.
Yeah, and I read that your neighborhood also was the childhood neighborhood of Larry David and Mel Brooks. I'm trying to think of Woody Allen.
Yes.
What is it about
Joseph
that neighborhood?
Joseph Heller. I mean, there's a lot of... The thing was, it was like the Jamaica of comedy where I grew up in Brooklyn. It was like the golden triangle of Jewish comedy. I don't know why, if it was in the water or the bagels, or what it was, but all those people grew up in that basic neighborhood and had that shared sensibility, even from different generations. Woody Allen is a generation ahead of Larry. Larry's a generation ahead of me, and yet still, there's a lot of shared reference points in that experience and growing up in that experience, in that environment. But it also added urgency and stakes to getting out and getting away from it and making something of yourself. And that's where I connected with the higher stakes that I found in other countries for people who did comedy.
In the moment, did you feel any part of the heritage of comedy in your blood? And, you know, I know that you come from an entertainment family. So, you know, I kind of admire you in some ways because, you know,
only
I like all
ways?
The, well, in many ways, but okay. Well, one of the many ways, you know, I grew up liking all the stuff that you like, you know, Milton Berle and Woody Allen and all that stuff, Mel Brooks. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I grew up outside of Houston in Texas where, you know, until I was in college, I probably met one Jew my whole life until I turned 18. And it was my French teacher, Judy Feinstein. And like, she would like kind of sign off on things if I wanted to like go on the PA system and acknowledge Irving Berlin's 100th birthday or something like
that.
But I had to seek out things. I had to go to Blockbuster and find a Mel Brooks movie or, you know, find order radio tapes of George Burns and stuff like that.
Well,
I feel like you're very lucky to have been kind of immersed in that.
That's the word that I would use as well. That's the word that I often use. And I reached a point in my life where that has become acutely clear to me is the role that luck plays in our lives.
Yeah.
When I met these other comedians and I looked at myself versus them and realized, well, it's just the luck of the demographics, of the geography. My parents happened to grow up here in New York. Second generation immigrant parents, very common occurrence in New York at that time. So I was lucky. I was a white kid. I grew up in that neighborhood where comedy was sort of was a priority. And my father was, you know, a failed comedian. And my mother was an entertainer who loved to eventually move to the condos in Florida and starred in the condo shows. So she was able to fulfill her dream.
Yeah.
So I was surrounded by it. And that's an environmental thing that I had no control over at all. So it's a very, very lucky thing that I was there at that moment. If I had been somewhere else, the story would be completely different. We wouldn't be here.
I read that you grew up in a housing project called Trump Village. Is that the same Trump?
That's the same. It's his
or
dad.
His Trump
dad.
Sr.?
Yeah. Trump Fred. Sr. But Trump Jr. was a Donald. He wasn't Jr. The father's name is Fred.
Yeah.
But Donald was around quite a bit. We had a new Little League field built there after a couple of years. And I remember him coming to the dedication of the Little League field.
Oh, yeah?
And he was probably 16, 18 years old at the time. But he still had the hair. And it was him.
At that age?
You know?
Was he wearing a suit?
He was wearing a suit for sure, yes.
To and a Little League dedication.
You know, if you're from New York, you have a certain perception of who Donald Trump is.
Yeah.
And I think for half those people, they think it's a goof that he became president. And for the other half, they are horrified.
Yeah.
And that's how it sort of breaks down.
And now I've heard all these awful stories of how terrible Fred Trump was to his tenants and how he would discriminate against African-Americans. Did you ever see any evidence of that?
None. None at all. I was a kid. I was not paying attention to that stuff at all.
Now, when you were starting out as a comedian, what was your act like? You said that you weren't very good. What kind of stuff did you...
I had very... You know, the thing that I observed about comedians, the comedians that I loved, and I would see them, like, do their act, and then I might see them elsewhere, like on a talk show or something. And I realized that the best comedians are the ones that could be the best versions of themselves on stage.
Okay.
They didn't need to be the funniest person off stage, mm-hmm. but on stage they could conjure up that persona, George Burns, Jack Benny, Bob Hope, Jerry Seinfeld.
Yeah.
They were able to be the best versions of themselves on stage. And then afterwards they didn't need to be the funniest person, you know? Mm-hmm. I could not, no matter how many times I got on stage, I was young. And maybe I would have gotten better at it, but I could not be my best version of myself on stage. I was too self-conscious. I would get nauseous beforehand.
Really?
I hated doing the same material over and over again, which is a crucial part of being a comedian, is doing the same material and making it sound fresh every night.
Yeah.
I couldn't do that. I didn't have the discipline at that time to go get up and tell the same jokes that I told the day before. So I was constantly churning out new material, which was good, but it also meant that I had no act, really, to speak of, you know? Mm-hmm. And I eventually felt like I was kind of fighting a rising tide, and I decided maybe I would try to sell some of my jokes because I had so many. And I used to be a parking valet in Los Angeles, and this is the late 70s. And again, we talk about luck. I decided I would go to the Comedy Store. I didn't know anything. It's before computers, and I would handwrite jokes on a piece of yellow legal pad. And I'd go stand in front of the Comedy Store, and when I saw a comedian that I recognized, I'd say, "You want to buy a joke?" And people started buying my jokes.
Really?
And it happened that the Comedy Store at that time...
That was the place.
It was
like
a golden age
for
of comedy.
From the East.
Richard
yeah.
Pryor was trying out his material for his concert movies. Robin Williams was just breaking in. David Letterman and Jay Leno were the kings of the Comedy Store. They were the two best comedians there.
Wow.
So there was a whole world of comedy that I was just able to kind of move about in very freely and sell my jokes until somebody got a job on a TV show and recommended me. So, again, luck.
Yeah.
Luck plays a gigantic...
Yeah.
I mean, I was
and
able to deliver.
And, you know,
yes.
and a little bit of street smarts, just willing to be willing to do whatever it takes, you
and
know,
when
sit
the time
and stand
came,
outside.
Absolutely. Right. I had no self-consciousness about doing that. I had self-consciousness about being on stage. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, I think when I look back, I didn't have any fear of rejection either. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't have any fallback position. This was going to be it. I'm committed. I was all in, you know, and it happened to work out. I happened to get lucky. That's
really interesting because it's kind of like what you were talking about. You couldn't be fearless on stage because you were so self-conscious. But, you know, if you weren't on stage and you were hustling and selling jokes, you could do away with all that and just
I was my best version of myself off stage, you know. That was a key difference, yeah.
And I think that was around the time that you met Larry David when you were doing stand-up. You two were in the same stand-up circles, right, in the
70s?
Well,
I did not know him at all.
Oh, you didn't?
No, I didn't meet him until I got hired as a writer on Fridays, and he had been cast as a writer and an actor on Fridays.
Okay.
And that's what we met on the TV show Fridays.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, did you ever see him when he was doing his act in those days?
No. Once he was
live?
On Fridays, I would go with him
oh, really?
Often to see his act and saw him do some. He was like Johnny Rotten of stand up comedy.
That's
at that
what
time.
I've heard. He would like get in arguments with the audience or walk off.
Yes. I've seen him spit at people, I've seen him throw the microphone down in anger and storm off. But he had amazingly great, original, unique, hilarious material.
Yeah, he's one of those guys who it seems like he could have gone one way or the other. He could have been a huge success with Seinfeld and Curb, or he could have just ended up being a raving lunatic on the street because he would refuse to compromise.
I completely agree with you. I mean, I've often made that observation about both him. I work with Bob Dylan also.
Oh, yeah.
And both of those guys are people, they are men who would do exactly what they're doing at a bus stop if they didn't have the success that they had.
Yeah.
This is what they do. This is what they have. This is what they have to offer. You accept it or not. They are the most uncompromising people I've ever known in my life.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Larry Charles when we come back in just a minute. It happens to the best of us. Right before a big deadline, or just when you're printing handouts for a key presentation, the printer runs out of ink. Then you have to go through that expensive hassle of replacing ink cartridges. Thankfully, with an internal ink storage tank, larger ink cartridges, and an intelligent page gauge that displays ink levels, Brother Ink Vestment Tank Color Inkjet all-in-one printers deliver ultra convenience along with a low cost per page and affordable upfront pricing. Enjoy uninterrupted printing with your choice of up to 1 or 2 years of ink included in the box. Ink Vestment Tank printers can keep your business running while delivering super functionality, including print, copy, scan, and fax. With Ink Vestment Tank, there's no sweating over your printer running out of ink, just the features, convenience, reliability, and affordability you need. Learn more at changethewayyouink.com and get ready to change the way you ink. And now, back to the podcast. What was the Dylan movie like? I haven't seen it. I think it was called Masked and Anonymous, right?
Correct. Yes.
It's semi-autobiographical, right?
Well, I wouldn't say that exactly. It's like most of Bob Dylan's work, it's very coded. And so there's a lot of insights into who he is, but it's not in any way a biography or an autobiography or reflective of his real life.
It's kind of Curb-like, right?
Okay,
I haven't seen it. I should see
it. It's very scripted and yet very spontaneous and improvised feeling. It's got an amazing cast. Bob, but there's also John Goodman, Jeff Bridges, Penelope Cruz, Jessica Lange.
Wow.
Yeah, amazing cast. And many more. Ed Harris. Cheech Marin, there's a whole, Chris Penn was in it, Christian Slater, just a really, really large cast, great cast, all because of Bob, of course.
Wow.
And so it doesn't fit into any category, which is one of the problems they had with the movie. It's a very surreal, I used to call it a spaghetti Western sci-fi musical. That's really what it is.
Yeah, I know. He's interesting because I have such admiration for him. He really is a genius. And it seems like he's kind of gone from early on kind of fighting to be understood to now reveling in being misunderstood.
Wow, is that a correct read? So interesting you say that, because that is one of my great conversations with him.
Really?
Because he was like a guru for me. I mean, I sat in a room with him for 2 years writing. And he would just pop out with these things, and I'm like, oh, my God, I can't believe it. And one day he would have all these little scrap papers with little notes on them that we would use in the script. We would kind of incorporate them. And one of them said, I ain't no pig without a wig. And I was like, we were writing for a while at this point. And so I felt comfortable enough to go, and I'm just as far from him as I am from you. And I go, Bob, I have to tell you. You know, as weird and surreal as this movie is going to be, that line doesn't make any sense.
That's like a lyric from a song, though.
Well, it wasn't at that time.
It's the same type of thing.
It wasn't at that time. It was just this weird line on a piece of paper. And I said, no one's going to understand that line. And he actually said to me, what's so bad about being misunderstood? And it's like, wow, man, you're right. Yeah. You know, he has been understood, just as you said. He has done that. Mm-hmm. He has done the understanding thing.
Yeah.
He's curious about what happens when people don't understand. He's curious about the spaces, the silences. He's very curious about all those things. It's fascinating.
That's interesting because that's kind of like Larry David. You
know,
he revels in, just loves the awkwardness and the silence, the weird parts of life.
They're both geniuses from very humble backgrounds also. Their parents would give you no indication that they were going to produce a Bob Dylan or a Larry David. It's a very interesting process, you know.
Now, what was it like being on the first few seasons of Seinfeld? Because I have to think that it was a point where the network really didn't know what to make of it, and probably even the TV audience that first season didn't know what to make of it.
Yeah. It was interesting because Larry said to me when I first came to work on the show, look, we'll do 13 episodes. It'll get canceled. We'll make a little money, and we'll go on with our lives. And
I can't tell you how many shows I've heard that about, Simpsons or whatever. They get told, yes, it's never going to go more than a season, but you'll make some money, and it won't do any damage to
you. And those are the hits. Those wind up being the hit shows because you approach those shows with abandon.
Mm-hmm.
And so we didn't know the rules to follow them. We never made sitcoms before. So we were making it up as we went along. We did what we thought was funny, and we really fully expected it to be done after 13 episodes. And instead, NBC was in third place, and they were kind of desperate and didn't have anything better to put on. So they kept on picking it up with a lot of reservations. The first testing that people hated George, and there was all this kind of negative testing on the show, but it hung in there. It stayed alive somehow. We were losing in those days to a show called Jake and the Fat Man.
Oh, yeah.
With William Cannon, a really bad detective show. And we were also losing to like Richard Lewis's Anything But Love.
Oh, okay.
And Richard Lewis and Larry David were very close friends, and their relationship was really kind of being pulled apart a little bit by that competition. And then eventually our show became the big hit, and his show got canceled, and that kind of reversed that competition thing. So at first fairly much of an abject failure, but people stuck with it for a variety of reasons, and eventually it had the opportunity to go from Wednesday night to Thursday night following
NBC's
Cheers.
Big day,
And Larry David, I'll never forget it, Larry David was told, hey, we want to move the show to after Cheers on Thursday. Everyone was so excited. Jerry's managers and Castle Rock and NBC, everyone was so excited. Larry was like, anybody who doesn't watch the show on Wednesday can go fuck themselves. Part of my language, but that's a quote, and they all went no, you don't understand. And they actually managed. And Larry's a very hard person to convince once he's made up his mind. But they convinced him to let the show go on Thursday, and that's what really catapulted the show in terms of awareness.
Yeah, and I think one of the things was it was a show that was straight up funny more than anything else. Because prior to that, it seems like all the sitcoms that were out were family sitcoms that had to have so many layers to them, or worse, I don't know if you remember this, when you would have the sitcoms that did the serious episodes
where they
would roll the credits with no music afterwards.
Well, you know, Ben, I love your perceptions because I completely agree, of course. And that is one of the keys to the success of Seinfeld at the time when it first came on, and why it held on and why it's still successful today. And that is because it actually delivers the goods.
Yeah.
It's actually funny, and it's still funny, and funny is in short supply. You're absolutely right. Most sitcoms, especially at that time, when they were in that kind of format where there had to be morality, where there had to be all these rules, where you had three scenes and everybody had to come in and tell some kind of contrived story.
Yeah.
We were allergic to all that, you know, and we just didn't do that. And the audience felt liberated. They were looking for that thrill of being honest in a sitcom. And it really kind of cut through past all the layers that usually are out, the filters. It got through to the audience in a pure form, made them laugh, and nothing will attract an audience like the guarantee of laughter.
Yeah, and I used to hear that Larry's process would be first thing Monday, he would ask you guys, hey, what happened to you over the weekend? Or what happened to you when you went to lunch today? And then you would just kind of build off of that.
Everything during the years we were on Seinfeld, your antenna were up all the time. You were certainly culling stories from your past, but you were looking at every situation you were in as a potential story. Just like you're saying, Larry and I would go out to lunch on Ventura Boulevard at Art's Deli, and we went to pay the bill, and the cashier didn't have change, and she had to go in the back to get a roll of quarters, and by the time she came out and gave us the quarters, we walked outside and bumped into somebody we didn't want to see, we've been avoiding for 20 years, because she had to go get the quarters. That became an episode about running the Pez dispenser where she runs outside and bumps into a guy she didn't want to see. So everything in life was constantly a source of potential material. And Larry, of course, was the bravest. No matter how humiliating the incident was, he would use it. So you had no excuse.
Now, somewhere I read that your inspirations were Abbott and Costello, Dragnet, and Superman. I totally get Abbott and Costello. I can see that. I can even see Dragnet in the library episode, but Superman, I don't get it. Help me out here.
But Larry, Jerry, and myself, and most kids in New York around that age were Superman freaks, the TV show with George Reeves. In the same way that Abbott and Costello, there was a kind of a weird, almost Beckett-like surrealism to the Abbott and Costello TV show. Superman also was kind of like, because it was a backlot, cheap version, not the versions we see today, but with bad sets and gangsters. They never had any like superhero villains. It was all just gangsters and fedoras. And there was something very, I don't think we knew it at the time, but it was kind of cheesy, but also very Menichean, very black and white.
Okay.
You know, Superman wouldn't kill anybody, but he was committed to truth, justice, and the American way. There was, and it was on, like all these shows, by the way, constantly in New York over and over and over again until it became part of your DNA. And you would roll, you would model yourself, if you could, after Superman in a way. Everybody wanted to be Superman. He was really the only big superhero. Batman was around, but he wasn't a TV show yet at that time.
Oh, yeah.
So to me, I think the way it applied later on is that Jerry, to some degree, is Superman in the show, you know?
Not just in the commercials.
And right. He's Superman. Elaine is kind of like Lois Lane. George is kind of like Jimmy Olsen. And I'm not sure who
Kramer.
Kramer's always Kramer, no matter what. But I think that Superman-like mentality and morality, Jerry's very above the fray all the time, almost like he's from another planet. And I think there is that quality to the show, inadvertently. Again, a lot of the things that wind up in these shows happened just kind of by happenstance. Something is mentioned, we like it, we go with it, we have the instinct to trust it, and it works out. Sometimes it doesn't, but a lot of the in that particular scenario with Seinfeld, most of our choices and decisions really worked out.
Whenever I talk to TV writers, they usually tell me that every TV writer has one character on the show that they particularly gravitate towards, and for you, that was Kramer. Kramer was kind of your baby. Well, what does that tell us about you?
Well, first of all, Kramer was a real person. The original Kramer is a real person. Yeah, he was Larry David's next-door neighbor.
Okay.
His name was Kramer. And he was a comedian as well, actually. Kenny Kramer, his name is. He's still around. Yeah. Very nice guy. And the only reason that I gravitated to Kramer, first of all, I had worked with Michael as I worked with Larry on Fridays. So I knew Michael.
Oh, right. Yeah. Was on
but that. Larry was channeling himself through George. Jerry was Jerry. Elaine, none of us knew how to write a woman character at first, so I was afraid. But Kramer was the character that was not really claimed in those early days. In fact, he was intended to just kind of come in the apartment door, say something, and leave, and never be part of the stories.
Yeah.
And I thought, for me to find my way in this, I could take advantage of expanding Kramer. So I started to put Kramer more into the A stories and the B stories, so he was a more integral part of the plot. And we had fun with that. It became fun to sort of expand Michael and Kramer's character. And that's why I was able to sort of take that character and mold him. And what it says about me is we have a lot of shared interests.
Oh, yeah,
conspiracies,
like
okay. extremism, you know, a lot of weird esoterica is something that I kind of tried to inject into Kramer's character.
Do you have a hot tub in your living room?
I didn't, but I would. And also, my best friend was Bob Sacamano.
Oh, that's a real person?
That's a real person also, yeah.
Yeah, Bob Sacamano. Isn't Bob Sacamano kind of like this character that's never seen on screen but
never
always
seen.
Referenced?
Yes, yes, exactly.
Now, later on, what was it like directing Curb Your Enthusiasm? Because I've always heard that Larry kind of just operates off of an outline, and it's pretty much improvised, right?
Well, let me say, just to preface that by saying how important Larry David has been to me, because I was a sketchwriter on Fridays, and he went off and did, when he finally did Seinfeld, he said, come and write on the show with me. And he asked me to do it, and I became a sitcom writer. I became a Seinfeld writer, you know?
Wow.
When he was doing Curb, he knew that on Seinfeld, I always stood on the floor during rehearsals and the shoot behind him saying, we need that reaction shot or we should be closer here. I was always giving him, you know, kind of directorial notes.
Okay. So you were the backseat director, huh?
I was a kind of a backseat director. And when he did Curb, he said, you know, you should direct one of these. And I'd never directed anything at that time. So
he
made me a writer and he made me a director. Really, again, luck.
Huh.
But I was always able to deliver the goods. So even though I had the good luck of the opportunity, I was also always able to capitalize on it. But he said to me, why don't you direct one of these? And I directed one of the early I appear in the pilot as myself. But I directed one of the early episodes and started directing the episodes and learned how to be a director on the set of Curb.
What is it about you that you're drawn to these savant-like artists, whether it's Dylan or Larry or Sacha Baron Cohen, who seemed to be totally fearless and willing to put everything on the table?
Well, most of my friends in Brooklyn were like that.
Yeah.
They were only without show business and without structure, without economic benefits.
Yeah.
That's just who they were.
Yeah.
They were kind of crazy guys who'd run on the railroad tracks and do really wild, wild things that were scary, but also hilariously funny.
But also probably difficult to work with. right? Difficult. I mean, how do you manage that?
I would put it, I would say challenging.
Okay.
Challenging, because if you can tap into it, you're going to get something that you would never get during the normal process. And I like the idea of finding something that's hidden and that has to be uncovered.
Yeah.
So with those guys, that's all there. You have to just give it the right environment to flourish.
You have this new show, and you're going to be stepping in front of the camera for this, although you've done some small parts here and some character work, most recently in The Comedians, which I loved and was really upset when that got canceled, by the way.
Yes, all of us. Thank you.
When you did Borat, was that kind of the beginning of that? Because I assume that you had to kind of act while you were directing on that thing, because you had to convince the people that he was interviewing that it was all part of this Kazakhstani media production.
Yes,
TV
there was like
show.
There was like two movies going on, because there was a movie that wasn't being shot, which is the movie that set up the movie that we did shoot. And I had to be, I used an assumed name.
What was your name?
Larry Carlson.
Oh, so you were an American.
I was an
cameraman or whatever.
You know, like the great thing about Sasha and why I thought he should have been nominated for an Academy Award is that performance, you have to keep in mind, he leaves the hotel in the morning and he's Borat, and that's it. He is Borat.
Yeah,
he's wearing Borat's underwear. Yeah. He's wearing Borat's ring. He's wearing Borat's socks. He's Borat. When I would argue with him, he would argue with me as Borat. So he would be standing closer than I am to you with people all day long, and he's got to make it real. You know, so we didn't want anything around him that felt fake at all, because he had to really sell the reality of that character. So I was a freelance documentary filmmaker. This was my little crew. We were hired by some organization to follow this guy for a couple of days.
Which makes sense, because realistically, that's probably how he wouldn't bring a crew from Kazakhstan.
Exactly. So then we would use that. We would say, please be patient with him. You know, he doesn't really know very much. He's never been to this country. The basic things that we take for granted in this country, he doesn't know the language.
So you could kind of set it up with
exactly. And so people were prepared to be patient with him to the point that they eventually became pissed off.
Is it true that he didn't shower the whole time?
Yes, he had some brilliant psychological tricks that he would use to force the quote target to submit. One of them was stinking. His body odor. He would hug people, and he smelled really, it was tough to smell him. And he would hug people, and if people tolerated the hug, he knew he had them, he could be dominant over them in this dynamic. The other thing he did with men was he would kiss men when he greeted them. He would always kiss them, and whether they were white supremacists or whatever they were, if he was able to kiss them and they allowed it, he knew he would have some dominance over those people, some control. So those were little tricks that he used to sort of test how much he could push these people, how pliant they would be in those situations. Yes.
Did putting yourself in these situations where things could have easily gone sideways on Borat or Bruno, did that prepare you for this new show a little bit?
It inspired me, really, because the idea of not knowing what's going to happen, of discovering, that's really what movie making and art really should be. Yeah. I think we live in a world now, in America particularly, where everything is so predictable, you know, and I was at that point in my life when that came along, I was looking for something that would break me out of the Los Angeles studio sitcom world. Mm-hmm. And here this thing comes along. It's like a new experience, a life-changing experience, really. And the invigoration of not knowing what's going to happen, I found very it was a change in my whole perception of life.
Had you ever watched any of the Borat HBO series?
Yes,
before
I was a gigantic fan. Gigantic fan of that show.
I have to ask some more about Larry Charles' Dangerous World of Comedy before we go.
Yes.
What are some of the other countries that you go to?
We went to Turkey, but we had to leave kind of quickly because we got some people upset. So there's nothing about Turkey in the current four episodes.
Okay.
But I shot in Turkey. I shot a number of comedians in Turkey. We went to then Iraq, Jordan, Palestine. I did a great sequence in Palestine with a great Palestinian comedian named Adi Khalifa, but it was such a long piece because I met his family and I went to this workshop that he conducts in Nazareth, so I couldn't use it in the show. It took up too much room. I'd like to put it out there. I'm trying to get Netflix to figure out a way to release some of this extra stuff that I have.
How was the chicken there?
Fantastic. I'm actually wearing the shirt right now.
Oh, the shirt from the Curb Your Enthusiasm?
From the Palestinian Chicken. I'm actually right. wearing the shirt. So weird that you would say that. See, we're very in sync, man. Then we went to, after Nazareth, we went to Saudi Arabia. Then we went to Nigeria, Liberia, Somalia.
Now
to
Somalia,
Mogadishu.
How do you even do something like that?
Well, when I was researching, when I started to think this is a good idea for a show, I have to see if this premise actually holds up. I started Googling the craziest places I could think of and comedy. So I would Google Somalia and comedy, and all these comedians would come up. Yeah. And so I started to have, when I finally had a research team, we researched the comedians, we got in contact with them, and we went to see them.
I mean, are you nuts? I mean, they kidnap Americans and behead them in Somalia. It's like a whole business there.
It was the place that I had the most regrets. I mean, look.
Regrets or reservations?
No, once I was there and trapped like in a traffic jam with people with machine guns everywhere and camo and checkpoints and soldiers, and you don't know who's who, and you have no way out, and you're trapped, I would think to myself, what was I thinking? And I had those moments. I talk about it in the show.
Yeah.
I talk about my second thoughts in the show sometimes where I put myself at risk. Why? You know, I could stay home. I live in Malibu, for God's sakes. What am I doing in Mogadishu, you know? So I had a moment like that in Somalia. It was a little scary. And right after we left, by the way, there was a bomb blast right where we were. Because if you're in Mogadishu, there's only really one road that connects everything. So there was a gigantic bomb blast in a bus. 550 people were killed just after we left. So again, we've talked about luck. Maybe that's the theme of our interview because I said to my crew, because we had a security guy who was fantastic.
Yeah, and he's like, going to say, how much security did you have to get in that situation?
I had one guy. And we had like a local team help us also.
Okay.
But those
guys were easily bribed, and some of them worked for militias.
You never know.
I had a guest on who was a reporter who supposedly had a guy.
Yes.
And then he gets
you
kidnapped.
You're trusting guys and
like
you really don't know. And they have the guns and you don't.
Yeah.
You know, and so so our security guy said, look, if anything happens, you follow me, you do this. And he started giving us, and I was like, forget all that. You know, we're here for 3 days. We have to get lucky. If something happens, you run like hell in any direction you can get in and hide, because that's the only way we're going to survive this. We're going to get lucky or not. We're going to get blown up or we're going to get back to the airport and get out of here. And we got lucky. I mean, to me, that was ultimately about getting lucky. And we did get lucky in that case.
Yeah. Now, in Iraq, I also read that you visited an ISIS prisoner in jail. Did he have a good sense of humor, or what was that about?
I think he wanted to be a little lighter and looser than he was able to be. He was
their image.
He was in cuffs and leg chains and while I talked to him. And the generals and the soldiers were all surrounding us. So he couldn't really get too loose with me. But I did have a very good conversation with him and the general of the prison as well.
Oh, yeah?
Who was a fascinating kind of raconteur who told me all kinds of funny stories about death,
waterboarding.
Death and destruction and torture in Iraq, yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Larry, you have a very distinctive look and always have. And I know that you've, like I said, done a little bit of character work on Seinfeld, Curb, the comedians as well. But this is the first time that you're pretty much carrying an entire show that actually bears your name in the title. Are you ready for the public life and total strangers coming up to you like they know you now?
Well, I've always had a slightly weirdly cult following, you know?
Oh, yeah?
I mean, I could go, like I was in Nigeria and someone was driving by and they went, Larry Charles. Like I get recognized in weird places, you know? So I kind of enjoy, because it's very low key, generally speaking. Yeah. It's people that like my work and want to just say hello. I love that. It's okay. Even when people are a little off, I really don't mind it that much. I love those encounters and interactions. Yeah. So I really don't mind that. I kind of see myself in this show as the Werner Herzog of comedy, you know? It's not like I'm really out there so much, but it's like I felt like I have the integrity and the authenticity to be the person to tell the story.
Do you ever have people who come up to you and they think they know you or they mistake you for someone else?
I went to visit my aunt in a nursing home before she died and went with my father. We walked into the nursing home and she was sitting there in a wheelchair with all these other women. And when I walked in, she went, look, my nephew, Larry David. So, yes, it does happen. It does happen. I get mistaken for all kinds of people. People say ZZ Top. Rick Rubin was a very close friend of mine.
Okay, I can see that.
People get us confused. So although if you look at us closely, of course, none of us look anything alike, but people get confused.
I just have to ask then, I forget what it was, the HBO movie that Larry did, Larry David,
yes.
Where he has to go unshaven
yes.
and he's kind of hiding out from the public and so forth. Did you inspire that look?
I didn't.
No.
I think he's always envied.
Yeah, I'll bet.
My hirsute appearance in some ways. And so I'm sure it kind of crossed his mind, but we really didn't discuss it.
Well, Larry, I already did it.
Yeah,
oh, Jesus.
It I do it myself.
Larry Charles, Dangerous World of Comedy is available on Netflix beginning February 15th. Definitely check it out. Larry, thanks for talking with me.
It was my pleasure. It was great. Thank you.
Thanks again to Larry Charles for coming on the podcast. Larry Charles' Dangerous World of Comedy is available beginning February 15th on Netflix. And follow Larry on Twitter at LarryCharlesism. Whatever struggles you're facing, from depression and anxiety to trauma and grief, BetterHelp can connect you with a professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. It's so convenient you can schedule secure video or phone sessions as well as chat and text with your therapist. And anything you share is completely confidential. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. Kick-Ass News listeners even get 10% off your first month with the discount code KICK. So why not get started? Simply go to betterhelp.com/kick and fill out a questionnaire to get matched with a counselor you'll love today. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already. And if you like what you're hearing, then rate and review us while you're there. 5-star reviews are the easiest way for new listeners to find us. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod. And feel free to email me with your thoughts, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Until next time, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.